many than the male. Many are capable of cultivating the taste when the opportunity presents itself. Fifth, humans are mildly polygynous, so males are apt to sire bastards who become rivals to their legitimate heirs. Sixth, humans are multiparous, having several offspring over their reproductive careers. This sets the stage for parent-offspring conflict, in which a son may want to take over a lineage's reproductive franchise before a father is through with it, and sibling rivalry, in which a later-born may covet the parental investment lavished on a first-born. Seventh, humans are nepotistic, investing in their siblings' children as well as in their own. Each of these biological realities, and often several at a time, left room for disagreement about who was the appropriate successor of a dead monarch, and the Europeans hashed out these disagreements in countless dynastic wars. Luard designates 1559 as the inception of the Age of Religions, which lasted until the Treaty of Westphalia ended the Thirty Years' War in 1648. Rival religious coalitions, often aligning with rulers according to the principle un roi, une loi, une foi, one king, one law, one faith, fought for control of cities and states in at least 25 international wars and 26 civil wars. Usually, Protestants warred against Catholics, but during Russia's time of troubles, an interregnum between the reign of Boris Godunov and the establishment of the Romanov dynasty, Catholic and Orthodox factions vied for control. The religious fever was not confined to Christendom. Christian countries fought Muslim Turkey, and Sunni and Shiite Muslims fought in four wars between Turkey and Persia. This is the age that contributed three atrocities in the top 21 list. The era broke new records for killing, partly because of the advances in military technology such as muskets, pikes, and artillery. But that could not have been the main cause of the carnage, because in subsequent centuries the technology kept getting deadlier, while the death toll came back to earth. Luard singles out religious passion as the cause. It was above all the extension of warfare to civilians who, especially if they worshipped the wrong god, were frequently regarded as expendable, which now increased the brutality of war and the level of casualties. Appalling bloodshed could be attributed to divine wrath. The Duke of Alva had the entire male population of Narden killed after its capture, 1572, regarding this as a judgment of God for their hard-necked obstinacy in resisting, just as Cromwell later, having allowed his troops to sack Drogheda with appalling bloodshed, 1649, declared that this was a righteous judgment of God. Thus, by a cruel paradox, those who fought in the name of their faith were often less likely than any to show humanity to their opponents in war. And this was reflected in the appalling loss of life, from starvation and the destruction of crops, as much as from warfare, which occurred in the areas most ravaged by religious conflict in this age. Names like the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War, together with the never-equaled spike in war durations, tell us that the wars of religion were not just intense, but interminable. The historian of diplomacy, Garrett Mattingly, notes that in this period, a major mechanism for ending war was disabled. As religious issues came to dominate political ones, any negotiations with the enemies of one state looked more and more like heresy and treason. The questions which divided Catholics from Protestants had ceased to be negotiable. Consequently, diplomatic contacts diminished. It would not be the last time ideological fervor would act as an accelerant to a military conflagration. Three currents in the Age of Sovereignty. Historians consider the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648 not only to have put out the wars of religion, but to have established the first version of the modern international order. Europe was now partitioned into sovereign states rather than being a crazy quilt of jurisdictions nominally overseen by the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. This Age of Sovereignty saw the ascendancy of states that were still linked to dynasties and religions, but that really hung their prestige on their governments, territories, and commercial empires. It was this gradual consolidation of sovereign states, culminating a process that began well before 1648, that set off the two opposing trends that have emerged from every statistical study of war we have seen. Wars were getting less frequent, but more damaging. A major reason wars declined in number was that the units that could fight each other declined in number. Recall from Chapter 3 that the number of political units in Europe shrank from 500 around the time of the 30 Years' War to fewer than 30 in the 1950s. Now, you might think that this makes the decline in the frequency of wars just an accounting trick. With the stroke of an eraser, diplomats remove a line on a map that separates warring parties and magically take their conflict out of the interstate war books and hide it in the Civil War books. But in fact, the reduction is real. As Richardson showed, when we hold area constant, there are far fewer civil wars within national boundaries than there are interstate wars crossing them. Just think of England, which hasn't had a true civil war in 350 years, but has fought many interstate wars since then. It is another illustration of the logic of the Leviathan. As small baronies and duchies coalesced into larger kingdoms, the centralized authorities prevented them from warring with each other for the same reason that they prevented individual citizens from murdering each other, and that farmers prevent their livestock from killing each other. As far as an overlord is concerned, private quarrels within his domain are a dead loss. The reduction in the frequency of war is thus another manifestation of Elias's civilizing process. The greater lethality of the wars that did take place was the result of a development called the Military Revolution. States got serious about war. This was partly a matter of improved weaponry, especially cannons and guns, but it was more a matter of recruiting greater numbers of people to kill and be killed. In medieval Europe and the Age of Dynasties, rulers were understandably nervous about arming large numbers of their peasants and training them in combat. One can hear them asking themselves, what could possibly go wrong? Instead, they assembled ad hoc militias by hiring mercenaries or conscripting miscreants and ne'er-do-wells who could not buy their way out. In his essay, War-Making and State-Making as Organized Crime, Charles Tilly wrote, in times of war, the managers of full-fledged states often commissioned privateers, hired sometime bandits to raid their enemies, and encouraged their regular troops to take booty. In royal service, soldiers and sailors were often expected to provide for themselves by preying on the civilian population, commandeering, raping, looting, taking prizes. When demobilized, they commonly continued the same practices, but without the same royal protection. Demobilized ships became pirate vessels, demobilized troops, bandits. It also worked the other way. A king's best source of armed supporters was sometimes the world of outlaws. Robin Hood's conversion to royal archer may be a myth, but the myth records a practice. The distinctions between legitimate and illegitimate users of violence came clear only very slowly, in the process during which the state's armed forces became relatively unified and permanent. As armed forces became more unified and permanent, they also became more effective. The thugs who had made up the earlier militias could hurt a lot of civilians, but they were not terribly effective in organized combat because bravery and discipline held no appeal. Mueller explains, the motto for the criminal, after all, is not a variation of semper fi, all for one and one for all, duty, honor, country, banzai, or remember Pearl Harbor, but take the money and run. Indeed, for a criminal to perish in battle, or in the commission of a bank robbery, is essentially absurd. It is profoundly irrational to die for the thrill of violence, and even more so for the procurement of booty, because you can't, after all, take either one with you. But during the military revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries, states began to form professional standing armies. They conscripted large numbers of men from a cross-section of society rather than just from the dregs at the bottom. They used a combination of drill, indoctrination, and brutal punishment to train them for organized combat. And they instilled in them a code of discipline, stoicism, and valor. The result was that when two of these armies clashed, they could rack up high body counts in a hurry. The military historian Azar Ghat has argued that revolution is a misnomer for what was really a gradual development. The process of making armies more effective was part of the centuries-long wave of technological and organizational change that made everything more effective. Perhaps an even greater advance in battlefield carnage than the original military revolution has been attributed to Napoleon, who replaced set battles in which both sides tried to conserve their soldiers with bold attacks in which a country would deploy every available resource to inflict all-out defeat on its enemy. Yet another advance was the tapping of the Industrial Revolution, beginning in the 19th century, to feed and equip ever larger quantities of soldiers and transport them to the battlefront more quickly. The renewable supply of cannon fodder stoked the games of attrition that pushed wars farther out along the tail of the power law distribution. During this long run-up in military power, there was a second force, together with the consolidation of states, that drove down the frequency of combat. Many historians have seen the 18th century as a time of respite in the long European history of war. In the preceding chapter, I mentioned that imperial powers like Holland, Sweden, Denmark, Portugal, and Spain stopped competing in the great power game and redirected their energies from conquest to commerce. Breck writes of a relatively pacific 18th century, at least from 1713 to 1789. Luard notes that in the Age of Sovereignty from 1648 to 1789, objectives were often relatively limited, and many wars in any case ended in a draw, from which no country secured its maximum aims. Many wars were lengthy, but the method of fighting was often deliberately restrained, and casualties were less heavy than in either the preceding age or subsequent ages. To be sure, the century saw some bloody combat, such as the World War known as the Seven Years' War. But as David Bell notes, historians need to be able to make distinctions between shades of horror, and if the 18th century did not exactly reduce the slavering dogs of war to performing poodles, its conflicts still ranked among the least horrific in European history. As we saw in Chapter 4, this tranquility was a part of the humanitarian revolution connected with the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, and the dawn of classical liberalism. The calming of religious fervor meant that wars were no longer inflamed with eschatological meaning, so leaders could cut deals rather than fight to the last man. Sovereign states were becoming commercial powers, which tend to favor positive-sum trade over zero-sum conquest. Popular writers were deconstructing honor, equating war with murder, ridiculing Europe's history of violence, and taking the viewpoints of soldiers and conquered peoples. Philosophers were redefining government from a means of implementing the whims of a monarch to a means for enhancing the life, liberty, and happiness of individual people, and tried to think up ways to limit the power of political leaders and incentivize them to avoid war. The ideas trickled upward and infiltrated the attitudes of at least some of the rulers of the day. While their enlightened absolutism was still absolutism, it was certainly better than unenlightened absolutism and liberal democracy, which, as we shall see, appears to be a pacifying force, got its first toeholds in the United States and Great Britain. Counter-Enlightenment ideologies and the Age of Nationalism. Of course, it all went horribly wrong. The French Revolution and the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars caused as many as 4 million deaths, earning the sequence a spot in the 21 worst things people have ever done to each other, and poking up a major peak in the graph of war deaths. Luard designates 1789 as the start of the Age of Nationalism. The players in the preceding Age of Sovereignty had been sprawling dynastic empires that were not pinned to a nation in the sense of a group of people sharing a homeland, a language, and a culture. This new age was populated by states that were better aligned with nations and that competed with other nation-states for preeminence. Nationalist yearnings set off 30 wars of independence in Europe and led to autonomy for Belgium, Greece, Bulgaria, Albania, and Serbia. They also inspired the wars of national unification of Italy and of Germany. The peoples of Asia and Africa were not yet deemed worthy of national self-expression, so the European nation-states enhanced their own glory by colonizing them. World War I, in this scheme, was a combination of these nationalist longings. It was ignited by Serbian nationalism against the Habsburg Empire, inflamed by nationalist loyalties that pitted Germanic peoples against Slavic ones, and soon against the British and the French, and ended with the dismemberment of the multi-ethnic Habsburg and Ottoman empires into the new nation-states of Central and Eastern Europe. Loire ends his age of nationalism in 1917. That was the year the United States entered the war and rebranded it as a struggle of democracy against autocracy, and in which the Russian Revolution created the first communist state. The world then entered the age of ideology, in which democracy and communism fought Nazism in World War II and each other during the Cold War. Writing in 1986, Loire dangled a dash after 1917. Today, we might close it with 1989. The concept of an age of nationalism is a bit Procrustean. The age begins with the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars because they were inflamed by the national spirit of France. But these wars were just as inflamed by the ideological residue of the French Revolution, well before the so-called Age of Ideology. Also, the age is an unwieldy sandwich with massively destructive wars at each end and two record-breaking intervals of peace, 1815 through 54 and 1871 through 1914, in the middle. A better way to make sense of the past two centuries, Michael Howard has argued, is to see them as a battle for influence among four forces: Enlightenment humanism, conservatism, nationalism, and utopian ideologies, which sometimes joined up in temporary coalitions. Napoleonic France, because it emerged from the French Revolution, became associated in Europe with the French Enlightenment. In fact, it is better classified as the first implementation of fascism. Though Napoleon did implement a few rational reforms, such as the metric system and codes of civil law, which survive in many French-influenced regions today, in most ways he wrenched the clock back from the humanistic advances of the Enlightenment. He seized power in a coup, stamped out constitutional government, reinstated slavery, glorified war, had the Pope crown him emperor, restored Catholicism as the state religion, installed three brothers and a brother-in-law on foreign thrones, and waged ruthless campaigns of territorial aggrandizement with a criminal disregard for human life. Revolutionary and Napoleonic France, Bell has shown, were consumed by a combination of French nationalism and utopian ideology. The ideology, like the versions of Christianity that came before it and the fascism and communism that would follow it, was messianic, apocalyptic, expansionist, and certain of its own rectitude. And it viewed its opponents as irredeemably evil, as existential threats that had to be eliminated in pursuit of a holy cause. Bell notes that the militant utopianism was a disfigurement of the Enlightenment ideal of humanitarian progress. To the revolutionaries, Kant's goal of perpetual peace had value not because it conformed to a fundamental moral law, but because it conformed to the historical progress of civilization. And so they opened the door to the idea that in the name of future peace, any and all means might be justified, including even exterminatory war. Kant himself despised this turn, noting that such a war would allow perpetual peace only upon the graveyard of the whole human race. And the American framers, equally aware of the crooked timber of humanity, were positively phobic about the prospect of imperial or messianic leaders. After the French ideology had been disseminated across Europe at the point of a bayonet and driven back at enormous cost, it elicited a slew of reactions which, as we saw in Chapter 4, are often lumped together as counter-enlightenments. Howard sees the common denominator as the view that man is not simply an individual who, by the light of reason and observation, can formulate laws on the basis of which he can create a just and peaceful society, but rather a member of a community that has molded him in a fashion he himself cannot fully comprehend and which has a primary claim on his loyalties. Recall that there were two counter-enlightenments which reacted to the French disruptions in opposite ways. The first was Edmund Burke's conservatism, which held that a society's customs were time-tested implementations of a civilizing process that had tamed humanity's dark side, and as such deserved respect alongside the explicit formal propositions of intellectuals and reformers. Burkean conservatism, itself a fine application of reason, represented a small tweaking of Enlightenment humanism. But that ideal was blown to bits in Johann Gottfried von Herder's Romantic Nationalism, which held that an ethnic group, in the case of Herder, the German folk, had unique qualities that could not be submerged into the supposed universality of humankind, and that were held together by ties of blood and soil rather than by a reasoned social contract. According to Howard, this dialectic between enlightenment and counter-enlightenment, between the individual and the tribe, was to pervade and to a large extent shape the history of Europe throughout the 19th century, and of the world the century after that. During those two centuries, Burkean conservatism, Enlightenment liberalism, and Romantic nationalism played off one another in shifting alliances, and sometimes became strange bedfellows. The Congress of Vienna in 1815, when statesmen from the great powers engineered a system of international relations that would last a century, was a triumph of Burkean conservatism, aiming for stability above all else. Nonetheless, Howard observes, its architects were as much the heirs of the Enlightenment as had been the French revolutionary leaders. They believed neither in the divine right of kings nor the divine authority of the church, but since church and king were necessary tools in the restoration and maintenance of the domestic order that the revolution had so rudely disturbed, their authority had everywhere to be restored and upheld. More important, they no longer accepted war between major states as an ineluctable element in the international system. The events of the past 25 years had shown that it was too dangerous. The great powers took on the responsibility of preserving peace and order, which they pretty much equated, and their Concert of Europe was a forerunner of the League of Nations, the United Nations, and the European Union. This international leviathan deserves much of the credit for the long intervals of peace in 19th century Europe. But the stability was enforced by monarchs who ruled over lumpy amalgams of ethnic groups, which began to clamor for a say in how their affairs were run. The result was a nationalism that, according to Howard, was based not so much on universal human rights as on the rights of nations to fight their way into existence and to defend themselves once they existed. Peace was not particularly desirable in the short term. It would come about only when all nations were free. Meanwhile, nations claimed the right to use such force as was necessary to free themselves by fighting precisely the wars of national liberation that the Vienna system had been set up to prevent. Nationalist sentiments soon intermixed with every other political movement. Once nation-states emerged, they became the new establishment, which the conservatives strove to conserve. As monarchs became icons of their nations, conservatism and nationalism gradually merged. And among many intellectuals, romantic nationalism became entwined with the Hegelian doctrine that history was an inexorable dialectic of progress. As Lewarde summarized the doctrine, all history represents the working out of some divine plan. War is the way that sovereign states, through which that plan manifested itself, must resolve their differences. leading to the emergence of superior states, such as the Prussian state, representing the fulfillment of the divine purpose. Eventually, the doctrine spawned the messianic, militant, romantic nationalist movements of fascism and Nazism, a similar construction of history as an unstoppable dialectic of violent liberation, but with classes substituted for nations, became the foundation of 20th century communism. One might think that the liberal heirs of the British, American, and Kantian Enlightenment would have been opposed to the increasingly militant nationalism. But they found themselves in a pickle. They could hardly defend autocratic monarchies and empires, so liberalism signed on to nationalism in the guise of self-determination of peoples, which has a vaguely democratic aroma. Unfortunately, the whiff of humanism emanating from that phrase depended on a fatal synecdoche. The term nation or people came to stand for the individual men, women, and children who made up that nation, and then the political leaders came to stand for the nation. A ruler, a flag, an army, a territory, a language came to be cognitively equated with millions of flesh and blood individuals. The liberal doctrine of self-determination of peoples was enshrined by Woodrow Wilson in a 1916 speech and became the basis for the world order after World War I. One of the people who immediately saw the inherent contradiction in the self-determination of peoples was Wilson's own Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who wrote in his diary, "The phrase is simply loaded with dynamite. It will raise hopes which can never be realized. It will, I fear, cost thousands of lives. In the end, it is bound to be discredited, to be called the dream of an idealist who failed to realize the danger until too late to check those who attempted to put the principle into force. What a calamity that the phrase was ever uttered. What misery it will cause. Think of the feelings of the author when he counts the dead who died because he uttered a phrase." Lansing was wrong about one thing. The cost was not thousands of lives, but tens of millions. One of the dangers of self-determination is that there really is no such thing as a nation, in the sense of an ethno-cultural group that coincides with a patch of real estate. Unlike features of a landscape like trees and mountains, people have feet. They move to places where the opportunities are best, and they soon invite their friends and relatives to join them. This demographic mixing turns the landscape into a fractal, with minorities inside minorities inside minorities. A government with the sovereignty over a territory which claims to embody a nation will in fact fail to embody the interests of many of the individuals living within that territory, while taking a proprietary interest in individuals living in other territories. If utopia is a world in which political boundaries coincide with ethnic boundaries, leaders will be tempted to hasten it along with campaigns of ethnic cleansing and irredentism. Also, in the absence of liberal democracy and a robust commitment to human rights, the synecdoche in which a people is equated with its political ruler will turn any international confederation, such as the General Assembly of the United Nations, into a travesty. Tin pot dictators are welcomed into the family of nations and given carte blanche to starve, imprison, and murder their citizens. Another development of the 19th century that would undo Europe's long interval of peace was romantic militarism. The doctrine that war itself was a salubrious activity, quite apart from its strategic goals. Among liberals and conservatives alike, the notion took hold that war called forth spiritual qualities of heroism, self-sacrifice, and manliness, and was needed as a cleansing and invigorating therapy for the effeminacy and materialism of bourgeois society. Nowadays, the idea that there could be something inherently admirable about an enterprise that is designed to kill people and destroy things seems barking mad. But in this era, writers gushed about it. War almost always enlarges the mind of a people and raises their character. Alexis de Tocqueville. War is life itself. We must eat and be eaten so that the world might live. It is only warlike nations which have prospered. A nation dies as soon as it disarms. Émile Zola. The grandeur of war lies in the utter annihilation of puny man in the great conception of the state, and it brings out the full magnificence of the sacrifice of fellow countrymen for one another, the love, the friendliness, and the strength of that mutual sentiment. Heinrich von Treitschke. When I tell you that war is the foundation of all the arts, I mean also that it is the foundation of all the high virtues and faculties of man. John Ruskin. Wars are terrible, but necessary, for they save the state from social petrifaction and stagnation. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. War is a purging and a liberation. Thomas Mann. War is necessary for human progress. Igor Stravinsky. Peace, in contrast, was a dream, and not a pleasant one at that, wrote the German military strategist Helmut von Moltke. Without war, the world would wallow in materialism. Friedrich Nietzsche agreed, "It is mere illusion and pretty sentiment to expect much, even anything at all, from mankind if it forgets how to make war." According to the British historian J. A. Cram, peace would mean a world sunk in bovine content, a nightmare which shall be realized only when the ice has crept to the heart of the sun and the stars, left black and trackless, start from their orbits. Even thinkers who opposed war, such as Kant, Adam Smith, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Oliver Wendell Holmes, H. G. Wells, and William James, had nice things to say about it. The title of James's 1906 essay, "The Moral Equivalent of War," referred not to something that was as bad as war, but to something that would be as good as it. He began, to be sure, by satirizing the military romantics' view of war. Its horrors are a cheap price to pay for rescue from the only alternative supposed of a world of clerks and teachers, of coeducation and zoophily, of consumers' leagues and associated charities, of industrialism unlimited and feminism unabashed. No scorn, no hardness, no valor anymore. Fie upon such a cattle yard of a planet. But then he conceded that we must make new energies and hardihoods continue the manliness to which the military mind so faithfully clings. Martial virtues must be the enduring cement, intrepidity, contempt of softness, surrender of private interest, obedience to command, must still remain the rock upon which states are built. And so he proposed a program of compulsory national service in which our gilded youths would be drafted off to get the childishness knocked out of them in coal mines, foundries, fishing vessels, and construction sites. Romantic nationalism and romantic militarism fed off each other, particularly in Germany, which came late to the party of European states and felt that it deserved an empire too. In England and France, romantic militarism ensured that the prospect of war was not as terrifying as it should have been. On the contrary, Hilaire Belloc wrote, "How I long for the Great War! It will sweep Europe like a broom." Paul Valéry felt the same way. "I almost desire a monstrous war." Even Sherlock Holmes got into the act. In 1914, Arthur Conan Doyle had him say, "It will be cold and bitter, Watson, and a good many of us may wither before its blast, but it's God's own wind nonetheless, and a cleaner, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine when the storm has cleared." Metaphors proliferated. The sweeping broom, the bracing wind, the pruning shears, the cleansing storm, the purifying fire. Shortly before he joined the British Navy, the poet Rupert Brooke wrote, "Now God be thanked, who has matched us with his hour, and caught our youth and wakened us from sleeping, with hand made sure, clear eye, and sharpened power, to turn as swimmers into cleanness leaping." Of course, the swimmers weren't leaping into clean water, but wading into blood. So commented the critic Adam Gopnik in a 2004 review of seven new books that were still, almost a century later, trying to figure out exactly how World War I happened. The carnage was stupefying. 8.5 million deaths in combat, and perhaps 15 million deaths overall, in just 4 years. Romantic militarism by itself cannot explain the orgy of slaughter. Writers had been glorifying war at least since the 18th century, but the post-Napoleonic 19th had had two unprecedented stretches without a great power war. The war was a perfect storm of destructive currents brought suddenly together by the iron dice of Mars, an ideological background of militarism and nationalism, a sudden contest of honor that threatened the credibility of each of the great powers, a Hobbesian trap that frightened leaders into attacking before they were attacked first, an overconfidence that deluded each of them into thinking that victory would come swiftly, military machines that could deliver massive quantities of men to a front that could mow them down as quickly as they arrived, and a game of attrition that locked the two sides into sinking exponentially greater costs into a ruinous situation, all set off by a Serbian nationalist who had a lucky day. Humanism and totalitarianism in the age of ideology. The age of ideology that began in 1917 was an era in which the course of war was determined by the inevitabilist belief systems of the 19th century counter-enlightenment. A romantic, militarized nationalism inspired the expansionist programs of fascist Italy and imperial Japan, and with an additional dose of racialist pseudoscience, Nazi Germany. The leadership of each of these countries railed against the decadent individualism and universalism of the modern liberal West, and each was driven by the conviction that it was destined to rule over a natural domain, the Mediterranean, the Pacific Rim, and the European continent, respectively. World War II began with invasions that were intended to move this destiny along. At the same time, a romantic, militarized communism inspired the expansionist programs of the Soviet Union and China, who wanted to give a helping hand to the dialectical process by which the proletariat or peasantry would vanquish the bourgeoisie and establish a dictatorship in country after country. The Cold War was the product of the determination of the United States to contain this movement at something close to its boundaries at the end of World War II. But this narrative leaves out a major plot that perhaps had the most lasting impact on the 20th century. Mueller, Howard, Payne, and other political historians remind us that the 19th century was host to yet another movement, a continuation of the Enlightenment critique of war. Unlike the strain of liberalism that developed a soft spot for nationalism, this one kept its eye on the individual human being as the entity whose interests are paramount. And it invoked the Kantian principles of democracy, commerce, universal citizenship, and international law as practical means of implementing peace. The brain trust of the 19th and early 20th century anti-war movement included Quakers such as John Bright, abolitionists such as William Lloyd Garrison, advocates of the theory of gentle commerce such as John Stuart Mill and Richard Cobden, pacifist writers such as Leo Tolstoy, Victor Hugo, Mark Twain, and George Bernard Shaw, the philosopher Bertrand Russell, industrialists such as Andrew Carnegie and Alfred Nobel of Peace Prize fame, many feminists, and the occasional socialist. Motto: a bayonet is a weapon with a worker at each end. Some of these moral entrepreneurs created new institutions that were designed to preempt or constrain war, such as a court of international arbitration in The Hague and a series of Geneva Conventions on the conduct of war. Peace first became a popular sensation with the publication of two bestsellers. In 1889, the Austrian novelist Bertha von Suttner published a work of fiction called Die Waffen nieder, Lay Down Your Arms, a first-person account of the gruesomeness of war. And in 1909, British journalist Norman Angell published a pamphlet called Europe's Optical Illusion, later expanded as The Great Illusion, which argued that war was economically futile. Plunder may have been profitable in primitive economies, when wealth lay in finite resources like gold or land, or in the handiwork of self-sufficient craftsmen. But in a world in which wealth grows out of exchange, credit, and a division of labor, conquest cannot make a conqueror richer. Minerals don't just jump out of the ground, nor does grain harvest itself. So the conqueror would still have to pay the miners to mine and the farmers to farm. In fact, he would make himself poorer, since the conquest would cost money and lives and would damage the networks of trust and cooperation that allow everyone to enjoy gains in trade. Germany would have nothing to gain by conquering Canada, any more than Manitoba would have something to gain by conquering Saskatchewan. For all its literary popularity, the anti-war movement seemed too idealistic at the time to be taken seriously by the political mainstream. Suttner was called a gentle perfume of absurdity, and her German peace society a comical sewing bee composed of sentimental aunts of both sexes. Angel's friends told him to avoid that stuff, or you'll be classed with cranks and faddists, with devotees of higher thought, who go about in sandals and long beards and live on nuts. H.G. Wells wrote that Shaw was an elderly adolescent still at play. All through the war we shall have this Shavian accompaniment going on like an idiot child screaming in a hospital. And though Angel had never claimed that war was obsolete, he argued only that it served no economic purpose and was terrified that glory-drunk leaders would blunder into it anyway. That was how he was interpreted. After World War I, he became a laughingstock, and to this day he remains a symbol for naive optimism about the impending end of war. While I was writing this book, more than one concerned colleague took me aside to educate me about Norman Angel. But according to Mueller, Angel deserves the last laugh. World War I put an end not just to romantic militarism in the Western mainstream, but to the idea that war was in any way desirable or inevitable. The First World War, notes Luard, transformed traditional attitudes toward war. For the first time, there was an almost universal sense that the deliberate launching of a war could now no longer be justified. It was not just that Europe was reeling from the loss of lives and resources. As Mueller notes, there had been comparably destructive wars in European history before, and in many cases countries dusted themselves off and, as if having learned nothing, promptly jumped into a new one. Recall that the statistics of deadly quarrels show no signature of war weariness. Mueller argues that the crucial difference this time was that an articulate anti-war movement had been lurking in the background and could now say, "I told you so." The change can be seen both in the political leadership and in the culture at large. When the destructiveness of the Great War became apparent, it was reframed as the war to end all wars. And once it was over, world leaders tried to legislate the hope into reality by formally renouncing war and setting up a League of Nations to prevent it. However pathetic these measures may seem in hindsight, at the time they were a radical break from centuries in which war had been regarded as glorious, heroic, honorable, or in the famous words of the military theorist Karl von Clausewitz, merely the continuation of policy by other means. World War I has also been called the first literary war. By the late 1920s, a genre of bitter reflections was making the tragedy and futility of the war common knowledge. Among the great works of the era are the poems and memoirs of Siegfried Sassoon, Robert Graves, and Wilfred Owen, the best-selling novel and popular film All Quiet on the Western Front, T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, Hemingway's novel, A Farewell to Arms, R.C. Sheriff's play, Journey's End, King Vidor's film, The Big Parade, and Jean Renoir's film, Grand Illusion, the title adapted from Angel's pamphlet. Like other humanizing works of art, these stories created an illusion of first-person immediacy, encouraging their audiences to empathize with the suffering of others. In an unforgettable scene from All Quiet on the Western Front, a young German soldier examines the body of a Frenchman he has just killed. No doubt his wife still thinks of him. She does not know what happened. He looks as if he would have often written to her. She will still be getting mail from him. Tomorrow, in a week's time, perhaps even a stray letter a month hence, she will read it, and in it he will be speaking to her. I speak to him and say to him, "Forgive me, comrade. Why did they never tell us that you are poor devils like us, that your mothers are just as anxious as ours, and that we have the same fear of death, and the same dying, and the same agony?" "I will write to your wife," I say hastily to the dead man. "I will tell her everything I have told you. She shall not suffer. I will help her, and your parents too, and your child." Irresolutely, I take the wallet in my hand. It slips out of my hand and falls open. There are portraits of a woman and a little girl, small amateur photographs taken against an ivy-clad wall. Along with them are letters. Another soldier asks how wars get started and is told, "Mostly by one country badly offending another." The soldier replies, "A country? I don't follow. A mountain in Germany cannot offend a mountain in France, or a river, or a wood, or a field of wheat." The upshot of this literature, Mueller notes, was that war was no longer seen as glorious, heroic, holy, thrilling, manly, or cleansing. It was now immoral, repulsive, uncivilized, futile, stupid, wasteful, and cruel. And perhaps just as important, absurd. The immediate cause of World War I had been a showdown over honor. The leaders of Austria-Hungary had issued a humiliating ultimatum to Serbia, demanding that it apologize for the assassination of the Archduke and crack down on domestic nationalist movements to their satisfaction. Russia took offense on behalf of its fellow Slavs. Germany took offense at Russia's offense on behalf of its fellow German speakers, and as Britain and France joined in, a contest of face, humiliation, shame, stature, and credibility escalated out of control. A fear of being reduced to a second-rate power sent them hurtling toward each other in a dreadful game of chicken. Contests of honor, of course, had been setting off wars in Europe throughout its bloody history. But honor, as Falstaff noted, is just a word, a social construction, we might say today, and detraction will not suffer it. Detraction there soon was. Perhaps the best anti-war film of all time is the Marx Brothers' Duck Soup, 1933. Groucho plays Rufus T. Firefly, the newly appointed leader of Fredonia, and is asked to make peace with the ambassador of neighboring Sylvania. "I'd be unworthy of the high trust that's been placed in me if I didn't do everything within my power to keep our beloved Fredonia at peace with the world. I'd be only too happy to meet Ambassador Trentino and offer him, on behalf of my country, the right hand of good fellowship, and I feel sure he will accept this gesture in the spirit in which it is offered." "But suppose he doesn't? A fine thing that'll be. I hold out my hand and he refuses to accept it. That'll add a lot to my prestige, won't it? Me, the head of a country, snubbed by a foreign ambassador. Who does he think he is that he can come here and make a sap out of me in front of all my people? Think of it. I hold out my hand, and that hyena refuses to accept it. Why, the cheap, four-flushing swine. He'll never get away with it, I tell you." The ambassador enters. "So you refuse to shake hands with me, eh?" He slaps the ambassador. Ambassador: "Mrs. Teasdale, this is the last straw. There's no turning back now. This means war." Whereupon an outlandish production number breaks out in which the Marx Brothers play xylophone on the pickelhauben of the assembled soldiers and then dodge bullets and bombs while their uniforms keep changing, from Civil War soldier to Boy Scout to British Palace Guard to frontiersman with coonskin cap. War has been likened to dueling, and recall that dueling was eventually laughed into extinction. War was now undergoing a similar deflation, perhaps fulfilling Oscar Wilde's prophecy that, as long as war is regarded as wicked, it will always have its fascination. When it is looked upon as vulgar, it will cease to be popular. The butt of the joke was different in the other classic war satire of the era, Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, 1940. It was no longer the hot-headed leaders of generic Ruritanian countries that were the target, since by now virtually everyone was allergic to a military culture of honor. Instead, the buffoons were thinly disguised contemporary dictators who anachronistically embraced that ideal. In one memorable scene, the Hitler and Mussolini characters confer in a barber shop, and each tries to dominate the other by raising his chair until both are bumping their heads against the ceiling. By the 1930s, according to Mueller, Europe's war aversion was prevalent even among the German populace and its military leadership. The resentment of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles was high. Few were willing to start a war of conquest to rectify them. Mueller ran through the set of German leaders who had any chance of becoming chancellor and argued that no one but Hitler showed any desire to subjugate Europe. Even a coup by the German military, according to the historian Henry Turner, would not have led to World War II. Hitler exploited the world's war weariness, repeatedly professing his love of peace and knowing that no one was willing to stop him while he was still stoppable. Mueller reviews biographies of Hitler to defend the idea, also held by many historians, that one man was mostly responsible for the world's greatest cataclysm. After seizing control of the country in 1933, Hitler moved quickly and decisively to persuade, browbeat, dominate, outmaneuver, downgrade, and in many instances murder opponents or would-be opponents. He possessed enormous energy and stamina, exceptional persuasive powers, an excellent memory, strong powers of concentration, an overwhelming craving for power, a fanatical belief in his mission, a monumental self-confidence, a unique daring, a spectacular facility for lying, a mesmerizing oratory style, and an ability to be utterly ruthless to anyone who got in his way or attempted to divert him from his intended course of action. Hitler needed the chaos and discontent to work with, although he created much of it too. And surely he needed assistants, colleagues who were worshipfully subservient, a superb army that could be manipulated and whipped into action, a population capable of being mesmerized and led to slaughter, foreign opponents who were confused, disorganized, gullible, myopic, and faint-hearted, neighbors who would rather be prey than fight, although he created much of this as well. Hitler took the conditions of the world as he found them and then shaped and manipulated them to his own ends. 55 million deaths later, including at least 12 million who died in Japan's own atavistic campaign to dominate East Asia, the world was once again in a position to give peace a chance. The Long Peace. Some numbers. I have spent a lot of this chapter on the statistics of war. But now we are ready for the most interesting statistic since 1945. Zero. Zero is the number that applies to an astonishing collection of categories of war during the two-thirds of a century that has elapsed since the end of the deadliest war of all time. I'll begin with the most momentous. Zero is the number of times that nuclear weapons have been used in conflict. Five great powers possess them, and all of them have waged wars. Yet no nuclear device has been set off in anger. It's not just that the great powers avoided the mutual suicide of an all-out nuclear war. They also avoided using the smaller, tactical nuclear weapons, many of them comparable to conventional explosives, on the battlefield or in the bombing of enemy facilities. And the United States refrained from using its nuclear arsenal in the late 1940s, when it held a nuclear monopoly and did not have to worry about mutually assured destruction. I've been quantifying violence throughout this book using proportions. If one were to calculate the amount of destruction that nations have actually perpetrated as a proportion of how much they could perpetrate, given the destructive capacity available to them, the post-war decades would be many orders of magnitude more peaceable than any time in history. None of this was a foregone conclusion. Until the sudden end of the Cold War, many experts, including Albert Einstein, C.P. Snow, Herman Kahn, Carl Sagan, and Jonathan Schell, wrote that thermonuclear doomsday was likely, if not inevitable. The eminent international studies scholar Hans Morgenthau, for example, wrote in 1979, "The world is moving ineluctably towards a third world war, a strategic nuclear war. I do not believe that anything can be done to prevent it." The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, according to its website, aims to inform the public and influence policy through in-depth analyses, op-eds, and reports on nuclear weapons. Since 1947, it has published the famous Doomsday Clock, a measure of how close humanity is to catastrophic destruction, the figurative midnight. The clock was unveiled with its minute hand pointing at 7 minutes to midnight, and over the next 60 years it was moved back and forth a number of times between 2 minutes to midnight in 1953 and 17 minutes to midnight in 1991. In 2007, the Bulletin apparently decided that a clock with a minute hand that moved 2 minutes in 60 years was due for an adjustment. But rather than tuning the mechanism, they redefined midnight. Doomsday now consists of damage to ecosystems, flooding, destructive storms, increased drought, and polar ice melt. This is a kind of progress. Zero is the number of times that the two Cold War superpowers fought each other on the battlefield. To be sure, they occasionally fought each other's smaller allies and stoked proxy wars among their client states. But when either the United States or the Soviet Union sent troops to a contested region, Berlin, Hungary, Vietnam, Czechoslovakia, Afghanistan, the other stayed out of its way. The distinction matters a great deal because, as we have seen, one big war can kill vastly more people than many small wars. In the past, when an enemy of a great power invaded a neutral country, the great power would express its displeasure on the battlefield. In 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the United States expressed its displeasure by withdrawing its team from the Moscow Winter Olympics. The Cold War, to everyone's surprise, ended without a shot in the late 1980s, shortly after Mikhail Gorbachev ascended to power. It was followed by the peaceful teardown of the Berlin Wall, and then by the mostly peaceful collapse of the Soviet Union. Zero is the number of times that any of the great powers have fought each other since 1953, or perhaps even 1945, since many political scientists don't admit China to the Club of Great Powers until after the Korean War. The war-free interval since 1953 handily breaks the previous two records from the 19th century of 38 and 44 years. In fact, as of May 15, 1984, the major powers of the world had remained at peace with one another for the longest stretch of time since the Roman Empire. Not since the 2nd century BCE, when Teutonic tribes challenged the Romans, has a comparable interval passed without an army crossing the Rhine. Zero is the number of interstate wars that have been fought between countries in Western Europe since the end of World War II. It is also the number of interstate wars that have been fought in Europe as a whole since 1956, when the Soviet Union briefly invaded Hungary. Keep in mind that up until that point, European states had started around two new armed conflicts a year since 1400. Zero is the number of interstate wars that have been fought since 1945 between major developed countries, the 44 with the highest per capita income, anywhere in the world, again with the exception of the 1956 Hungarian invasion. Today we take it for granted that war is something that happens in smaller, poorer, and more backward countries. But the two world wars, together with the many hyphenated European wars from centuries past, Franco-Prussian, Austro-Prussian, Russo-Swedish, British-Spanish, Anglo-Dutch, remind us that this was not always the way things worked. Zero is the number of developed countries that have expanded their territories since the late 1940s by conquering another country. No more Poland getting wiped off the map, or Britain adding India to